Well, thank you so much. Let me extend my personal welcome to each of you to this leadership briefing. This is a fun event because it's good to see a flock of leaders together. It's hard to know exactly what a collective of leaders is. You don't look like a gaggle. You don't exactly look like a pack, but we'll just say a fleet of leaders gathered in one place. It's very impressive when you think about the stewardship of leadership that is entrusted to us. I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak today, and I wrote a book on leadership several years ago. And a part of this is risk. It's like a friend of mine who wrote a book on parenting. He said, I looked like a genius when my kids were in the sixth grade. Didn't feel like such a genius just 3 or 4 years later. In other words, you can write a book on leadership, you can write a book on parenting, but that's a moving target. So I'm actually revising the book just to talk about some of the changes in the terrain, but also some of the things I wish I had said in the first edition of that book. But nonetheless, one of my understandings of leadership is that we learn it from others. We learn by observation. And so a part of the fun of having a conversation like this about leadership is that we get to look to some of those models and mentors in leadership from whom we learn so much, the very real human beings. Being real human beings, we see them in their greatness, we see them in their weakness, but we learn from them. And there are some to whom we turn over and over again. We learn from the living and the dead. But I want to suggest to you, there are particular advantages to learning from the dead. For one thing, their story is finished. That's a certain comfort, as a matter of fact. There's a level of risk in attaching yourself to any model that's in motion, because you just don't know exactly where this is going to go. Learning from the dead also gives us the advantage of the distance of time. We're able to take the measure of a leader, probably to a far more accurate degree, over a period of time. So, we learn from the dead. Today, learning from Theodore Roosevelt. My title is In the Arena, Theodore Roosevelt and the Leadership of Action. As a speaker, I always require myself to have a title. Even when the audience doesn't know the title, I have to have a title. And the reason for that is that the title forces a speaker, or a writer for that matter, to be certain we know what we're supposed to speak or talk about. And a subject as immense as Theodore Roosevelt, you could think of many different aspects or dimensions you could rightly take as the focus of a discussion, even just on leadership. But it seems to me the one most important thing to say about Theodore Roosevelt is that he is one of history's sublime and supreme examples of leadership distilled into action. Some of you will recall these words from Roosevelt: it is not the critic who counts. The credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows that the end of things is high achievement, and at very worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. Roosevelt's entire understanding of leadership came down to the fact that what matters is what happens in the arena. Roosevelt understood that there's much more in terms of the background to leadership. But on the canvas of history, Theodore Roosevelt himself looms large as one who understood what it meant to be in the arena. Why are we talking about Theodore Roosevelt? History records him as the 26th president of the United States. And frankly, even as we think about the presidency, we need to recognize there were many presidents who influenced the office, who fleshed it out. But there are probably two who in the span of history are most important in this consideration. The first was George Washington, for whom the office was basically constitutionally defined. In terms of the founding era of the United States, the idea of a strong central chief executive was only plausible when the Constitution was framed because of the existence of George Washington and the assumption that he would be the first president of the United States. And yet the office wasn't fleshed out. It was constitutionally defined, but it was fleshed out by George Washington. Every subsequent president serves in an office defined by George Washington. But the second president in this perspective is actually Theodore Roosevelt, who became president in 1901. It was Theodore Roosevelt who invented the modern presidency. The presidency as we think of it today is largely the creation of one man, and that man was Theodore Roosevelt. We also know him historically as the hero of the Spanish-American War, and of course, internationally, Theodore Roosevelt is known as the first American recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Just to know those three things is to understand the immensity of the man. The closer you look, the more interesting the story becomes. He was born in October of 1858 in New York City. His father was also Theodore Roosevelt. The younger Theodore Roosevelt, who became president, had a son named Theodore Roosevelt Jr., and so you have to keep your Theodore straight. Theodore, the patriarch, was born into one of the most established families of Dutch New York. Many people forget the fact that it was originally New Amsterdam, that it was the Dutch who settled New York, and it was a particular mercantile class of the Dutch who established New York City as a city, a major city of commerce and a world city on the map. The aristocratic Dutch families formed the royalty of New York. Theodore Roosevelt was born into that royalty. So also would be his more distant cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was born into the Dutchess County extension of the very same family. But in understanding that, you have to understand that Theodore Roosevelt was born into a family in which doing something significant was expected. It was expected when Theodore Roosevelt was born in 1858 that he would have a major role to play in the expanding nation. But you also have to understand that Roosevelt was standing himself at the hinge of history. It was just as a very young boy. Indeed, he was 7 years old when he and his brother and the little girl who was their neighbor named Edith Caro stood at the front window of their house there in New York and watched the funeral cortege of Abraham Lincoln passing by. So in just this one man's life, in the life of Theodore Roosevelt, you have ties to the establishment of the American nation, and especially the establishment of New York City in terms of his ancestors. You had a father who had lived as the bridge between the founding generation and the latter part of the 19th century. You had Theodore Roosevelt born just in the second half of that century and being as a young boy a witness to the funeral cortege of President Abraham Lincoln. You also have to understand Theodore Roosevelt in his boyhood at this hinge of history. And you have to understand that this was a boy who in his boyhood did not appear to be the seed of greatness. He was afflicted with asthma. This was a particularly bad time for a boy to be afflicted with asthma in New York City. New York City was just entering the Industrial Revolution, and air pollution was a constant reality. Theodore Roosevelt, the boy, discovered something that was not told to him by doctors, but rather he discovered it on his own. When his family went on vacations into the mountains of New England, he could breathe. When he came back to the city of New York, he could not breathe. A love for the wilderness, and in particular, a love for exploration, was implanted in Theodore Roosevelt as a boy because it was in the woods that he could breathe and in the city where he could not. He had horrible eyesight. Now, eyesight so horrible that he would never excel in any kind of sport that involved a ball or anything else. He would eventually excel at one sport in which the action was no further than his fist. It was in boxing that he could actually demonstrate his athletic prowess. He was a weakling. He was puny by his own estimation. When he was about 12, he was beaten up by a gang of boys, came back to the house, and the father's answer was, "We're going to have to make something of you." And so they built one of the first home gyms in America. And again, it tells you something of the wealth of the family. No one thought of taking him to a gym. They simply built a gym. And Theodore Roosevelt excelled in the gym and actually became so muscular that he had to wear a man's clothes as a teenage boy. He was homeschooled. Very interesting background. His family, being Dutch Calvinists, they had joined the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church at that point. The aristocracy did not send their children to school at this time. They educated their children at home. But the boy was prepared for entrance into Harvard College. He entered Harvard, and of course also graduated from that institution, entered in 1896, and graduated in 1880. He had a basically happy childhood, except of course for the health struggles that he had to overcome. But there was one massive embarrassment in his life. He idolized his father, and his father he considered to be his closest friend. But his father had one major issue of life that horribly disappointed Theodore Roosevelt. His father had not fought in the Civil War. His mother was related to the family of Robert E. Lee. His father's family was one of the, of course, founding families of New York City. The Civil War was not merely a war that divided a nation, it divided families. And the way out of this for Theodore Roosevelt the elder was to pay someone to take his place in the Union Army. It was not at all uncommon. That was something that went back to a European tradition. It was not considered scandalous. It was not considered a loss of social status or even an abdication of responsibility, not to the people of the father's age, but to Theodore Roosevelt the son. It was a massive embarrassment. He felt that his father had forfeited his opportunity to make a difference in the war that he believed had greatly mattered. He carried that embarrassment to Harvard. At Harvard, he excelled. He became president of almost every student organization for which he was qualified, and he became very much a man about the campus. People said that when Theodore Roosevelt entered a room, energy entered the room. It was while he was at Harvard that his father died. And when his father died, Theodore Roosevelt himself became the patriarch of the family at about 20 years of age, a responsibility he took very seriously, taking over his father's many businesses, and at age 20, investing in what was then considered a rather risky financial operation, which was buying ranch land in the Dakota Territories. At that time, Theodore Roosevelt probably never intended to visit those ranches. They were merely an investment. He graduated from Harvard in 1880, and in that same year, he married his Harvard sweetheart, Alice Lee. He briefly studied law when they returned to New York City, but the law didn't interest him enough. He was interested in public service. Now, this is also interesting because people of Roosevelt's social class didn't run for public office. To put it as cynically as might be accurate, they didn't become politicians. They bought politicians. Theodore Roosevelt was offended by the very idea. The other thing to remember is that if you were looking for a model of near Sicilian political corruption in the United States, that would have been New York City at the very time Theodore Roosevelt graduated from Harvard. He went back to New York, started to study law, was so offended by the corruption he saw, Tammany Hall, the entire system of official corruption in New York City, he decided he would run for the General Assembly, and so he did. And so he was elected as the youngest member of the New York General Assembly. A couple of years later, he would be elected by the largest margin anyone was ever elected to the New York General Assembly, a record that stands to this day. The big turning point in his life, however, came in 1884. Roosevelt was a family man, and he was a man of wealth. Just 2 years after graduating from Harvard, he built Sagamore Hill in Oyster Bay in Long Island, a massive estate. He didn't build that estate in order to make a social statement. He built that estate in order to raise a family. Theodore Roosevelt was one of the greatest defenders of the family in all of American history. He believed that the nation would never be stronger than the life of its families, and he believed that any man who would make a difference, any leader who would dare to lead, had to have a family that demonstrated the substance of that leadership. He and Alice tried for a long time to have children, and the children were slow in coming, but then a little baby came, the baby we would know as Alice came. But on Valentine's Day, in the year 1884, the great turning point in Theodore Roosevelt's life, and that one day, as he was in Albany, he received word that Alice, his dear wife, was not well, though the newborn baby was thriving. The urgency came that he get to the city as quickly as possible. By the time Theodore Roosevelt walked into his home, his best friend greeted him at the door saying, "Alice is dying, and so is your mother." the two anchor points of his life died on the same day, Valentine's Day of 1884. It was the most devastating loss that Theodore Roosevelt would ever experience, and he felt that his life was over. As he said to his friends, "The light has gone out of my life." At that point, Theodore Roosevelt went into a massive depression. It was so massive that he had to leave New York City, and he had no idea where to go except to the West. Theodore Roosevelt headed for the Badlands of the Dakota Territories. He would spend the next 2 years reinventing himself. Having overcome adversity as a boy, he now had to overcome the massive loss that he felt would end his life as he was in the Badlands. At this point, Theodore Roosevelt enters the American imagination, because it was Theodore Roosevelt who, not single-handedly, but more than any other figure, invented the myth of the American West. He went to the Dakota Territories. He took the ranch that he bought. He bought a second ranch, and then he actually worked the ranch. This is Theodore Roosevelt on the back of a horse. This is Theodore Roosevelt with a gun on each side. This is Theodore Roosevelt, who was the great hunter, the great sportsman, the great rancher, and the great lawkeeper of the American West. This is the Theodore Roosevelt who would ride on horseback for 2 days to catch a horse thief and would bring him back single-handedly. This was the Theodore Roosevelt who became the great hunter and also the great environmentalist single-handedly. This was the Theodore Roosevelt who returned to New York 2 years later. This was the Roosevelt who wrote the multi-volume work, The Winning of the West, that in terms of American literature, really helped to establish the mythos of the American West. What you see played out by John Wayne was actually lived out a century earlier by Theodore Roosevelt. After 2 years of finding himself in the Badlands of the Dakota Territories, he returned to New York City. And when he returned to New York City, he meant to get about doing something that would change history. He was a widower. He had a young daughter. He desperately wanted a wife and a family. At a social occasion, he came to meet his eyes with the eyes of Edith Caro, that little girl who had stood beside him with his brother as they watched the funeral cortege of Abraham Lincoln when they were seven. And his eyes met, and then they got married. And Edith Caro became the second Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt, and to their marriage came five children. Eventually, Theodore and Edith would have four boys and a girl. You had Edith, he ended up with six children, four boys and a girl. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. was born in 1888, Kermit in 1889, Archie in 1894, Quentin in 1899, and then of course you also had Ethel, who was born in 1891. Now the interesting thing about those names is that almost every one of those boys worked his way into American history. Quentin became one of the earliest pilots in what would become the Army Air Corps and was shot down and killed during World War I in the Western Front. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. would become one of the most decorated general officers of the American Army during World War II and would be one of the commanding officers at D-Day, and he would shortly die in action after leading troops at D-Day. By the way, his first daughter, Alice, would marry Congressman Longworth, as in the Longworth Congressional Office Building in New York City, became Speaker of the House. She became one of the most famous figures in Washington, D.C. People said she, more than any other woman, represented Theodore Roosevelt in the flesh. And she was known for her witticisms. My favorite one is that she was kind of the grand dame of Washington, D.C. during much of the 20th century into the administration of John F. Kennedy. And she was known as the hostess with the mostest, so to speak. But she also was known as one of the most vivacious figures. She had her father's infectious personality. She had an embroidered pillow on her sofa when you came into her parlor in which it said, "If you can't say anything nice, come sit by me." Roosevelt is now married, building his family at Sagamore Hill. He has to decide what he's going to do with his life. In 1889, President Benjamin Henry Harrison appoints him one of the three civil service commissioners of the United States. Now, again, that may sound like a merely bureaucratic office, but you have to recognize there were three in the entire executive branch. there were three civil service commissioners. Why is that important? Because if graft and corruption is going to invade the United States government, that is where it will happen. It will be in commissions. It will be in the opportunity for people to buy office. One of the ways that Benjamin Henry Harrison ensured the integrity of the federal government was by appointing Theodore Roosevelt, the great anti-corruption leader of the New York General Assembly, to be one of three civil service commissioners. And Roosevelt thrived in the office. He became one of the most important figures in Washington, D.C. Edith moved with him. They moved their family there. Of course, they kept the estate at Oyster Bay, but they started establishing a Washington reputation. And he could have stayed in that office for a very long time, except for the fact that New York needed him. In 1895, he left that office in order to go back to New York as the police commissioner of New York. This is one of the missing pieces many people do not know of Theodore Roosevelt. He went back to New York City in order to be the police commissioner. Now, just imagine what you already know about Theodore Roosevelt. Nobody would have enjoyed being police commissioner more than Theodore Roosevelt. He loved breaking up organized crime. He loved cleaning up the police department of New York. And he thrived in that. He did such a good job, and as a matter of fact, that 2 years later, President William McKinley appointed him Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Now, here's a little footnote to Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt is the greatest presidential patron of the United States Navy in its history. He was in the Army, but he felt that the Navy was the great extension of American influence around the world. He had seen the example of the British Navy, and he felt that if America were to take its role on the world stage, it would have to build a similar navy. When he was at Harvard in his senior year, he wrote a thesis that became a major published book and is still a matter of American naval history on the American Navy in the War of 1812. Later, as president, it would be Theodore Roosevelt who would paint a massive fleet white, as you may remember. It was called the Great White Fleet, and he sent that American flotilla all over the world to go into ports around the world to announce, if you want to mess with the United States, you're going to mess with this. He became the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He was in that role when the Spanish-American War broke out. You'll recall that's the war that it may have emerged out of a misrepresentation, but it was, we need to recognize, the inevitable final collision between the United States and Europe. So many people don't recognize the Spanish-American War. You'll remember, was basically over who's going to have influence over the Americas. Will it be the United States, or will it be European powers and their continuing ambitions in the Americas? Later, Theodore Roosevelt would reset the Monroe Doctrine in a crisis in Venezuela, but at this point, he recognizes that the future of America and America's role in the world is going to come down to whether or not America wins the Spanish-American War. So the Assistant Secretary of the Navy goes to the President of the United States and asks for a personal commission as a colonel in the U.S. Army to establish a regiment of irregulars, of volunteers, who he will personally command in Cuba in the Spanish-American War. McKinley thinks he's a nut. He's Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Assistant Secretaries of the Navy become Secretaries of the Navy. They don't leave to become colonels in the Army to lead a regiment of irregulars, but Theodore Roosevelt did, because the one thing he feared more than anything else was being missing in action. There was the burden of his father's absence from the Civil War that Roosevelt felt he must rectify by personally being engaged in Cuba. No one knows where he came up with his military strategy. What was known is that he had one. His band of irregulars became absolutely necessary to key battles, most importantly, the Battle of Kettle Hill, you may remember. And that's better known as the Battle of San Juan Hill on July the 1st of 1898. And it was not only Roosevelt's readiness, it was actually the fact that he had his men ready, the Rough Riders, as he called them. They were ready for battle. It was regular troops who had engaged the enemy first, but they were being pressed back. Roosevelt arrives with his irregulars and saved the regular troops, but Roosevelt, basically against orders, went further to take the entire hill. The last part of the taking of the hill, he had to lead on foot because his horse had become entangled in barbed wire. Theodore Roosevelt was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously. people in the military were very offended by the idea that the colonel of an irregular unit could win the Congressional Medal of Honor, and thus they blocked it until they could block it no more after Roosevelt was dead. At that point, Roosevelt became a world figure and an American hero. He came back to the state of New York, and in 1898 was overwhelmingly elected the governor of the state of New York. In the year 1900, Republicans turned to him as the bottom of the ticket when William McKinley was running for re-election as president of the United States. Theodore Roosevelt's advisors told him, "Don't do it. The vice presidency is an absolute dead end." Theodore Roosevelt didn't want to do it. All the joy and energy of being police commissioner of New York paled over against the nothingness of being vice president of the United States. And by the way, at that point, the vice presidency was truly a nothingness. There were basically no duties that pertained to the office whatsoever. Roosevelt was nonetheless persuaded to do it. That helped McKinley towards re-election, which happened in the year 1900. He was inaugurated as vice president of the United States in January, at that time in May of 1901. On September the 6th, 1901, President McKinley was shot by an assassin at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. It was immediately thought the president would die, but the president rallied and it was believed that he would live. Theodore Roosevelt, being told that the president would recover, having no duties himself and not even being briefed by the cabinet of any pressing issues, went into the mountains in order to conduct the kind of weekend that he normally conducted. He was coming down the mountain and had reached 5,000 feet when a military aide was seen running up the mountain with a telegram. At that point, Roosevelt recognized what had happened. He had just become the 26th president of the United States. At that point, Theodore Roosevelt became and remains the youngest man ever to serve as president of the United States. There we have an interesting question. Just what kind of president was he? He was a Republican. He was a Republican progressive. You have to put any figure in his time. At that point, to be a progressive Republican was to understand the dangers of what we would now call crony capitalism. Roosevelt understood that much of the economy was set by a very few at the expense of the many. And in the name of Republican virtue, he crusaded against that kind of crony capitalism and what was known as trust busting. It was he who also understood that this was to be a nation for the people. And thus it was he who, as an environmentalist, created the system of national parks as we know them today. But he didn't hold to the view of many secular environmentalists these days that nature is thus to be worshipped and set apart. He believed that nature was to be observed. It was to be enjoyed. And so he established the national parks not as sanctuaries to nature, but rather as preserves on behalf of the people of the United States for their enjoyment. He was also involved in establishing the first food and drug laws in the United States. And even though today we suffer from far too much regulation, it is interesting to note that in the early 20th century, there was actually far too little. You had no trust whatsoever in drugs that you might purchase. You had no idea that it was actually anything like what was being sold. It was Roosevelt who brought these first laws into effect. Roosevelt was one of the earliest proponents of civil rights. It was Roosevelt who invited the first African-American guest as his guest to dinner at the White House. Roosevelt tried to push back against the Jim Crow laws of the South, but without much effect in the United States Senate. In retrospect, it was also Theodore Roosevelt, and this is very much a part of our current national conversation in this morning's news, it was Theodore Roosevelt who really developed the modern presidency by the issuance of executive orders. The federal government was lethargic. It was very difficult to get the government to do anything. It was much smaller than it is today. Roosevelt did not want it to be larger. He did want it to be accountable, and he wanted it to be active. And thus he issued executive orders. Congress at that time was largely inactive, and that pattern of executive orders is now very much a part of our controversy today in terms of the last administration, and now even in the news with a federal judge acting on an executive order today. It was Theodore Roosevelt who basically invented the executive order as a way of effecting change in the government. And this is, again, a reminder that some of this is for good and some of this is for ill. In other words, many of us would be very happy for Theodore Roosevelt to issue executive orders. But once you establish that within the office, someone else holding a very different understanding of government can use that same power. By the way, in terms of his environmentalism, it was Theodore Roosevelt who was president in 1902, was taken to Mississippi on a hunt. If you want to make the president happy, take him on a hunt. But it turned out that the hunt in Mississippi was rigged. And Roosevelt was taken to a bear to shoot, and the bear was tied to a tree. Theodore Roosevelt was a man of honor and a hunter of honor. He had no interest in having anything to do with shooting a bear tied to a tree, nor would he shoot a young bear. And so Roosevelt famously spared the bear. The greatest cartoonist of the age drew a cartoon of Teddy saving the little bear. Thus was born the teddy bear. And so American childhood was changed from that point onward because Teddy Roosevelt humanized the bear cub. No one thought of the bear cub as a cute, cuddly animal until Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy, by the way, hated to be called Teddy. However, he was always called Teddy. And he eventually came to understand that that was a word of affection. And thus, by the end of his life, he owned it. As president, again, he enforced the Monroe Doctrine. He built the Panama Canal. And that was the most massive public works project in all of human history to that point. And in so doing, we also have to be honest, he probably broke every international law we can imagine. And most of those laws weren't there. And the Panama Canal was built in what was, when Roosevelt took office, actually Colombia. And thus he negotiated with Colombia, which he considered to be an absolutely corrupt government, about buying the rights to the isthmus in order to be able to build the Panama Canal. He grew frustrated with the Colombians because he believed they were corrupt. And so he backed an insurrection in northern Colombia that created the nation of Panama that, by very strong coincidence, then gave the rights to build the Panama Canal to the United States. And you'll recall that Teddy Roosevelt's word when he thought that anything was good was bully. And so this was a bully new nation that had made a bully new deal for him to build his bully new canal. And again, our lives as we know it would not be the same without the Panama Canal. It's one of those many moves in history, which in retrospect would be morally complicated. But we also have to be honest and say, we're glad the canal happened. It'd be hard to imagine the modern nation as we know it without it. Teddy Roosevelt was reelected, that is actually elected for the first time to his full term in the election of 1904. He was elected by the largest electoral margin in American presidential history. Again, that stands to this day. When he was elected president, he turned to Edith, his wife, and said, "I am now no longer an accident." That second term in office was for Teddy Roosevelt a way of consolidating the gains, but it was also, he felt, in following the example of George Washington, his final term in office. He would have served 9.5 years as president of the United States. Excuse me, he would have served 7.5 years as president of the United States. And he felt that he should not run for a second full term, which would have extended his service beyond that of George Washington. It was a mistake he later greatly regretted. He anointed William Howard Taft as his successor, believing that Taft would follow in his policies. Taft was an extremely incompetent president of the United States. He lost control of the agenda. He actually retreated on many of Roosevelt's gains. It led to a division between Roosevelt and Taft. Roosevelt entered the race in 1912 for the Republican nomination. He defeated the incumbent president of the United States in all but one primary in the 1912 race for the Republican nomination. Nonetheless, the Republican nomination was controlled by the grandees of the party, not primarily by primary voters. Roosevelt was blocked. That infuriated him. He then declared he would run as a third-party candidate in what he described as the Progressive Party, later became known as the Bull Moose Party. In 1912, Roosevelt ran hard for the presidency, and up until the date of October the 14th, 1912, Roosevelt was in the lead in terms of all expectations of the presidential election. But on that day, he was shot. Preparing to give a speech in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Roosevelt was shot in the chest by a would-be assassin. He was bleeding profusely, but he insisted on giving his speech. What was interesting here is that it was Roosevelt the hunter who insisted on giving his speech. Why? Because as a hunter, he knew that if there were bubbles coming in the blood from the chest, that the lung had been penetrated. But if not, the lung had not been penetrated. He was bleeding profusely. It was idiocy. But he continued to give his address. He stood up in front of the crowd in Milwaukee and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether you fully understand that I've just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose," thus the Bull Moose Party. Roosevelt spoke for 90 minutes, by the way. He apologized for giving a short speech in 90 minutes. But he held his audience rapt and gained, again, an almost immortal status in imagination for his courage. He wouldn't even let being shot stop him. It turned out later that the bullet was just about an inch from penetrating his heart, so close that the surgeons could never remove it. He wore the bullet for the rest of his life. They couldn't keep the bull moose from giving his speech, but he was off the campaign trail for the rest of the race, and he did not win election. He did defeat the Republican candidate. This was the most successful third-party run in the history of the United States. He defeated his own previous party, but Woodrow Wilson was able to eke out a very narrow victory with only about 40% of the vote. Woodrow Wilson was elected with only about 40% of the vote and took office. Roosevelt was devastated. Immediately after he'd left office, he went on a grand tour of Europe and a grand safari in Africa. He was a man who was just filled with too much energy to be still. When he lost the election in 1912, he decided he still wanted to do something great. He knew his electoral political life was over. He said to Edith, "This is my last chance to be a boy." And he set it off to chart the uncharted darkness of the River of Doubt in the Amazonian wilderness. Roosevelt set out with an expedition he, of course, would lead. It was a successful expedition in terms of mapping out the River of Doubt. No one knew where it began. No one knew where it ended. Roosevelt's expedition, you remember, this was the great age of exploration. They didn't have Google Maps. They had no idea what was inside much of the Amazonian jungle. But one of the things that was inside the Amazonian jungle was malaria. Almost the entire expedition was infected with malaria. Theodore Roosevelt had nearly lost his leg as a teenager. He had survived, the leg had overcome infection. It became re-wounded and the infection became pernicious. He got malaria and believed himself to be dying. He sat under a tree in the Amazon and told the expedition to go on. They did not. They saved Theodore Roosevelt and brought him back to civilization, but he was so weak, he was in a condition from which he would never recover. It was his last chance, he said, to be a boy, but it was one of the last experiences of his life. In 1914, when war struck, Theodore Roosevelt had been warning for years, like Winston Churchill with the rise of Nazi Germany, that the Kaiser would have to be defeated. Wilson, at that point, steadfastly argued that America keep out of the war. Wilson even won re-election pledging that America would keep out of the war. But when it came right down to it, there was no way to keep America out of the war. Theodore Roosevelt went to the President of the United States, of whom he had been a severe critic. That had to be an interesting moment when Theodore Roosevelt walked in to see the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. He asked Woodrow Wilson for the very same thing he had asked in the Spanish-American War, for a commission to raise up a regiment that he would take into war against the Kaiser. Wilson denied him that privilege, probably wisely. There's no way that Roosevelt physically actually could have carried that out. And furthermore, it would not be an asset to the United States government to have a former President of the United States as a potential prisoner of war on the Western Front. Roosevelt's four sons did go. All of them served on the Western Front. As you'll recall, Quentin, one of the earliest aviators, was shot down and killed, again, a wound from which both Theodore and Edith never really recovered. He was very proud of his son for fulfilling his service to the country, but as a father, he was brokenhearted, and he carried that all the way to the grave. January the 6th, 1919, Theodore Roosevelt died at Sagamore Hill. Now, here's what you need to remember. He was only 60 years old. So he died an old man at 60. One of the brothers immediately telegraphed to the other and said, "The lion is dead. And so he was. In 1925, the United States Congress approved what we know as Mount Rushmore, the carving into the side of this massive mountain, the four paradigmatic presidents of the United States. Even by 1925, it was apparent that those four would be George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt. What's amazing about that is that Roosevelt had only been dead 6 years. America was willing in 1925 to state that Theodore Roosevelt would be forever remembered as one of the indispensable presidents of the United States. It was in 1901 that he took office as president. From that year until this, there has never been a year in which a major book on Theodore Roosevelt has not been published. There are three questions we need to ask about any figure from the past. One of them is, how did he see himself or herself? What was the self-impression? Theodore Roosevelt believed himself to be a man with a mission, a man born to responsibility. He saw himself as one who would have to act where action was necessary in order that the right things would happen rather than the wrong things. A second question is to understand the times. Times create great leaders. There's no question about it. This was one of those turning points in history. You had the last stage of the great conflict between Europe and the United States over the Americas. You had a moment in American history in which the presidency had become an outdated institution. Someone would have to reinvent it. You had corruption at multiple levels of American government and the cry that someone would have to clean it up. And, of course, you had wilderness yet to be explored. All of these things called unto Theodore Roosevelt. Then you have to ask a third question. After the years, does this figure seem larger or smaller? Here's the amazing thing. Over the years, Theodore Roosevelt appears now larger rather than smaller. You look at all the presidents after him, and with some very rare exceptions, no one suggests there should be a new face carved into Mount Rushmore. Those exceptions are very rare. Almost every president after Theodore Roosevelt looked smaller than Roosevelt had when he was in office. Just a few issues about Theodore Roosevelt, some lessons to learn. First, a leader understands the necessity of action. Roosevelt's absolute maxim to his boys, to his cabinet, to the Rough Riders was this: action, action, and still more action. Roosevelt understood that leadership comes down to actions. It does have to take the form of words, but if it does not take the shape of action, nothing happens. He also understood that the wrong things will happen by lethargy and inaction. The right things only happen by action, an enormous exertion of action. For Theodore Roosevelt, this was physical action. He wanted to be seen constantly in action. He would rarely sit at a seat if he could stand. He would walk up to people and take them by the hand. He would look them squarely in the eye. He was constantly in motion, constantly in act. Tremendous energy, personal energy, physical energy, and intellectual energy. Thomas Edison and others are remembered as the great inventors. But Theodore Roosevelt, as president of the United States, was actually an operational scientist by our modern standards. He was a naturalist. He was an avid reader of science. He could converse with the leading scientists of the day. He understood that action is not just physical, it is also intellectual. Douglas Brinkley, one of the biographers of Roosevelt I most appreciate, in his book, The Wilderness Warrior, uses several terms to describe this leadership in action. He describes Theodore Roosevelt as a human blowtorch, as a human tidal wave. He described his method of leadership as throwing up skyrockets. And then at one point, this is very poetic, especially to a son of the South, he said that Theodore Roosevelt's life was the life of a boll weevil eating his way through a bale of cotton. And that's what he thought. It was just constant action, constant. And by the way, Roosevelt's teeth, you'll recall, were often an issue of the cartoon because he was often there with that gregarious smile. And then Brinkley says, like a boll weevil eating his way through a bale of cotton. This energy was absolutely infectious. And Roosevelt believed it was the first issue in leadership. Where leadership happens, action happens. And where the right leadership happens, the right actions happen. The second thing is, Roosevelt modeled the leader as moral courage. And by this, we do not mean at first physical courage. That physical courage was very clear. It was a moral courage. Roosevelt understood that leaders stand for convictions. My argument for convictional leadership finds one of his classic examples in Theodore Roosevelt. He said this. He said, a man is not a good citizen if he does not behave well in his own family. He's got to be a good breadwinner. And he went on to say that he has to be a neighbor of whom his neighbors can trust. The first duty, he said, of each one of us is to carry your own weight. He believed in moral responsibility. He wanted to see the nation take on its moral responsibility. He understood the threats to the family. Even in the early decades of the 20th century, he said this, the transformation of the family is one of the greatest sociological phenomena of our times. It is a social question of the first importance, of far greater importance than any merely political or economic question can be. It took a lot of moral courage to say that. We now talk about this as subsidiarity. It's the biblical principle that it's the smallest unit that has to take the greatest responsibility. It's marriage and family that bears the greatest responsibility for the entire holding together a civilization. There are responsibilities that pertain after that to community and neighborhood and government, but they can never replace, if broken, what is lost in marriage and the family. Roosevelt understood that. He lived it out in his family life. He once claimed that no man could have had a happier family life than did he. And by the way, he lived that out before the country. He let his boys play in the White House. He said, this is a house. This is a house. At one point, a German diplomat was staying in the White House and was awakened, what he thought was an ungodly hour in the morning, by four boys playing cowboys and Indians up and down the stairwells and the hallways of the White House. He stepped out to complain when all of a sudden the President of the United States came through playing cowboys and Indians with his boys. At which point the diplomat diplomatically decided this was not the right time to make it an issue. Theodore Roosevelt opened the White House from time to time to the American people to make clear, and he wanted them to bring their families. My favorite is a sign I saw in which he said, all Americans welcome to the White House this Sunday if you are sober, clean, and not wearing a bodily advertisement. Like three pretty good rules. You got to be sober and clean and not wearing a bodily advertisement. And then you're welcome to the people's house. In terms of moral courage, he was a staunch defender of human life, including the life of the unborn. He was a staunch defender of the sanctity of life extended to the dignity of all, including immigrants who came to the United States. He was a very clear and articulate defender of who he believed to be the defenseless. And remember, some of the earliest controversies over abortion are taking place in American culture at this time. Roosevelt was a stalwart defender of the sanctity of human life. He was publicly known to be a Christian. When he went to Harvard, he taught Sunday school every single Sunday. He upheld what he saw as the centrality of Christianity to the future of the nation, and he was commonly known to sing his favorite hymn, How Firm a Foundation. That was a hymn he lived out in terms of his life. The intellectual insight of someone like Thomas Jefferson is often neglected, but he said this, there are those who believe that a new modernity demands a new morality. What they fail to consider is the harsh reality that there is no such thing as a new morality. There's only one morality. All else is immorality. There's only the Christian ethics, over against which stands the whole of paganism. He went on to say, I mean to fulfill our great destiny as a people. If so, then we must return to the old morality, the sole morality. Now, there are very few presidents who would speak with that kind of clarity. But he did so in the first decade of the 20th century. He wrote over 35 books. By the time you figure out all the permutations, probably over 50. They included books with titles like The Foes of Our Own Household and Fear God and Take Your Own Part. Here he was calling the nation and summoning the nation to a leadership role in the world. The third lesson, very quickly, is that a leader combines both actions and words. It's easy to say that Roosevelt distilled everything to action, and as he would describe his leadership, he often did. But he also wrote 35 books. He gave virtually countless speeches and wrote countless articles. He did believe in the power of words. One of the things he believed about books is that books could speak where he could not. And like I say, he started writing and publishing books when he was a very young man, even as a student at Harvard. He would later write biographies of those he considered to be great men. Those who had influenced his life, wrote a biography of Governor Morris, one of the founders, wrote a biography of Oliver Cromwell, wrote a collection of biographical essays. He kept writing, and he did believe in the power of words. He believed in the power of books. But all of that was a way of getting from idea to action. The fourth thing we learn from Roosevelt is that a leader is always learning. The leader has to learn. It has to be a massive input. Roosevelt was a student. He was a reader to the very end of his life. Fascinated by the natural world and by science, he wanted to be conversant with the latest science, and he wanted to learn. Even as he admired Charles Darwin, not for his worldview, but for his naturalism, and he wanted like that to go to far places in the world, like the Amazonian jungle, in order to learn. He read history to the end of his life. He read biography to the end of his life, and he was involved in exploration, which again was for him a great intellectual endeavor of learning. Here again, you remember such things as the National Geographic Society. This was a way that Americans were seeking to understand the world. There were vast sections of the globe that were terra incognita. No one understood what was in there. Roosevelt wanted to send people to find, and he eventually also went himself to find. Finally, with Roosevelt, we have the example that the leader is always out in front. My favorite statement about this comes from a 17-year-old boy who signed up to serve under Theodore Roosevelt with the Rough Riders. 17 years of age, the boy wrote this. We were following Teddy. This is San Juan Hill. We were following Teddy. We'd been ordered to retreat before that, but it wasn't authenticated. Teddy didn't pay any attention to it anyhow. We just struck out and took the hill. We'll get everybody together, cavalry and some infantry. We went up the hill. It was wide open. We didn't run in a regular line. It was like a mob running up there. He said we were exposed to Spanish fire. Roosevelt went on and ran the trenches. He outran the trenches. He ran over the trenches. And he was maybe, he said, just 75 yards ahead of us. Then speaking of Roosevelt, the young man said, he was always ahead of us. Well, that's Roosevelt's understanding of leadership. The leader is ahead. In this case, 75 yards ahead under Spanish fire. He did not run behind his troops. He ran ahead of them. He showed them the way, ran over the trenches, opened the lines. In the arena is where Teddy Roosevelt intended to be. It's where Teddy Roosevelt was to the end of his days. He burned out at age 60. In terms of the stewardship of life, it's hard to say how we account for that. But he lived more in those 60 years than most men would in 600. He wrote about this in a speech he gave in 1905 that is probably the greatest distillation of his leadership. It's what he called the strenuous life. He said this, I want to preach not the doctrine of ignoble ease, but the doctrine of the strenuous life, the life of toil and effort, of labor and strife, to preach the highest form of success, which comes not to the man who desires more ease or peace, but to the man who does not shrink from danger, from hardship, or from bitter trial, and who out of those wins the splendid ultimate triumph. As you recall, in that speech in which he spoke of being in the arena, Roosevelt acknowledged that the leader isn't always on the winning side, that victory doesn't always come. But as he says, without the strenuous life, and unless one is in the arena, there's no possibility of victory. And even if there comes defeat, it's the right kind of defeat. It's being defeated in a valiant effort that was worth all the courage it took. Theodore Roosevelt's been dead now for almost a century. We know him as a face on Mount Rushmore. I think there's much more to him than that. And I wanted to share with you today why, when I look to Theodore Roosevelt, I find one of the great examples that encourages me as a leader. And I find endless resources to want to know more about a man who was in the arena and makes me want to stand with him in that very same arena. God bless you all. Thank you for coming. It's been a privilege to be with you.